Thank you very much, John. So my name is Robin Lovelace, and in a way, my talk isn't about cycling at all. It's about this. And if you don't know, this is the map for the first two phases of HS2, which is a huge project, £50 billion investment. And it's interesting to look at the numbers. I did a few calculations yesterday, and the target that a report in the UK to get Britain cycling was recommending £10 per person per year to get everyone cycling, which is way above current investment. If you take the 20-year build time for HS2 and divide the total cost by 20 years and apply it to everyone, that's £40 per person per year just to build the thing before anyone's even benefiting from it. So this shows the scale of the problem. And in a way, my research was initially looking at how to get people cycling, the factors that encourage people to start cycling. But as a side project to another project, a side strand, we were asked by the Department for Transport to look into this issue of when we build such a huge piece of infrastructure like the HS2 railway, what are the opportunities? So the Department for Transport was very much framing this in a positive way. They wanted to know what are the opportunities to build a parallel network of cycle infrastructure. But being an academic, I said, well, there's always costs and benefits to everything. So we decided to look both at the opportunities and the potential costs of building this infrastructure. We looked at the literature, as you always do, and a number of people have studied the impacts of large infrastructure on active travel, but there was no methodology, there was very little methodological work that actually looked at a way of quantifying such a huge issue. You've got loads of villages along the route, and some of these are going to get cut off. You also do have opportunities for building parallel routes, and what we needed was a way to evaluate this. But I should emphasize, this was quite a small part of a much bigger project. So it hasn't really, in the DfT's report on our work, they didn't actually publish this side report because I think it was a bit of a pet project of one of the people commissioning it. So if I can work out how to skip, I'll just scroll down. So that's what I'm going to be talking about. A little bit of context, a little bit about the impacts of transport infrastructure, but this is really about the methods that can be available, can be relatively objective, and hopefully can be used by anyone to assess these kind of impacts. So as we've just seen, although most people in this room are pro-cycling, we're pro-cycling infrastructure, the majority of infrastructure that goes in is not cycling infrastructure. And if we can find a way to evaluate what the impacts of this new infrastructure will be on cycling, then that could be a really good thing. So just a little bit on academic context. I have been working over the last 3 years on a project called the Propensity to Cycle Tool, and this is really kind of where this came from. We focused deliberately on taking a road network approach based on this paper, which is talking about the evolution of thinking about cycling infrastructure that started very much about points and areas, and then it shifted to looking at routes. So people wanted to build a cycle path from A to B, but now obviously the thinking has moved on, and we know now pretty comprehensively you need a cycling network. You can't have a route that does 97% of the way. You need a joined up network. And we started, we developed this tool that scales nationally, and for that reason, when I'm doing methodological work, I don't want to have a method that can just look at a local city or a local region. I want something that really scales. And that's some of the motivation behind this. But as I said, this research was looking at possibilities for growing cycling, but we wanted to look at if you change the infrastructure and build something that's not cycling infrastructure, what can happen? And one of the key concepts behind this is the concept of a desire line. People want to go from A to B, And if there was nothing in between, let's say Far Headingley and Central Leeds, people would probably just go in a straight line. But because of busy roads and because of buildings, you're forced to take it a route around it. And using this same concept, you can imagine if there's a huge railway line going straight across that, you're going to have to go a very, very long way around to get to that. So how can we use this concept of desire lines that are easily quantifiable using origin destination data, which are freely available from many government censuses around the world and also from smaller surveys, to try and evaluate it? So that's basically the one of the key concepts that we've used in the method. And just to provide a little bit of background, this is what we've used the methods on the propensity to cycle tool to look at. The map probably isn't that clear, but this is actually Bristol. We're somewhere up here. And what it allows you to do is, if you've got a model that operates at the desire line level, you can allocate those trips onto the road network, and you can estimate what the potential demand is at the road network level. So this is one of the key outputs of the propensity to cycle tool. This map is freely available across England, and it's being used by local authorities to design joined up networks. But you can imagine that if you have new linear infrastructure going in, that some of these relationships are going to fall apart, and you may not have a joined up network. So I'm a big fan of open source software, and one of the parts of being open source is also about being open about the limitations. So there are a number of major limitations on the propensity to cycle tool so far. So it doesn't currently account for future development, whether it's new housing or new infrastructure. It's currently very focused on commuter cycling, simply because that's what the best source of open data on travel behaviour. Although we have been funded recently by the Department for Transport to add a schools layer. We don't have integration with other transport modes, which I think is absolutely vital if we're going to get the growth in cycling that we need. And it has little account of future or even existing infrastructure. So in a way, this strand of the research was really interesting to me, because in addition to tackling a really interesting real-world problem, what's the impact of HS2 on cycling, we can also tackle some more fundamental limitations with a methodology that has the potential to help design cycling networks internationally. So because the, hopefully this thing will open. Yeah, so this is actually very politically relevant at the moment. Just a month ago, there was this article in the Guardian, which says that HS2 Limited, which is tasked with building HS2, is being accused of breaching its legally binding commitment to provide cycle-proofed infrastructure. So this has suddenly become potentially more of a hot potato. DFT has sat on the report that we wrote for them about the potential and the also the dangers with building large-scale infrastructure. So that's a little bit of policy context in addition to the academic and research context that I've talked about. And the scale of HS2, I've already talked about the funding, because that is really important. It's a huge project, but actually it's only 330 miles of track, and it costs about £100,000 per metre, which is incredibly high. If you build off-road infrastructure, so Dutch-style cycleways, you'll get around 100 metres for the same, for every metre of HST, you could get 100 metres of cycling infrastructure, so it's about £1,000 per metre. And there's a whole range of interventions that are way, way cheaper per metre than that. So I just think the numbers are really adding up. And what I would love to look at is, of those £55 billion that are spending, how many people actually benefit? And if you spent a similar amount of money on a large-scale cycling network, how many people would benefit and what would be the social distribution of the benefits. That's something that I want to take forward with this research, but I'm getting ahead of myself. And how much time do I have?
A couple of minutes.
Okay, that's good. So as we go down, I've got a image. Okay, now I don't have an image, but there's linking this to the literature on impact assessment. This is really the kind of policy area. So there is a huge amount of literature on environmental impact assessment, which is a mandatory legal requirement for anyone building new infrastructure. And there's been academic research that shows that not only does it have obvious environmental impacts when you build something, there's a natural experiment, for example, on a new motorway on the outskirts of Glasgow that went into residential areas. And they found evidence that it does have quite a strong impact on active travel. But the active travel wasn't part of the environmental impact. So it's one of these things that's growing over time. They say, oh, we have an environmental impact. And it's like, oh, but you need to make it strategic. Oh, but you need to have a health impact assessment. And all these additional impact assessments. But there's very limited requirements. I think there's no requirement to ensure that you have an active travel impact assessment. And I think that should be part of, an integral part of, the environmental impact assessment process. I spoke to someone who's a consultant who works in this area. So he goes around the world doing various impact assessments. And he said, if you build yet another branch of assessment, people are just going to have impact assessment overload. So let's just get active transport into the environmental impact assessment, which is actually broader than just environmental. So that's a little bit about the policy side. I'm not going to talk too much about it. This is, in a way, the kind of money shot of our research in terms of the method. So there's basically three types of major long-term impact when you build a new linear transport infrastructure. This kind of stuff's going in all around the world, and we may as well have some kind of understanding of it. Number one, I think, is severance. That is a huge issue whether you're building a motorway or a railway track. And we can use these methods that use freely available data and software to find out along that black line, which is the part that most urgently needs a bridge across it, for example. Or should we reroute the linear infrastructure to avoid places? And we can quantify how much severance is taking place across the route. You've got parallels, which is what the Department for Transport was very keen on emphasising with the HS2, where you build linear infrastructure alongside it. But having read into it, there's a lot of concern about having people near railways, and it doesn't necessarily make it easy. Just because you build a railway track doesn't necessarily mean it's more cost effective to build a cycleway. So in fact, the plans that I've seen around HS2 have a network that expands quite a long way out from the HS2. And then the final one that we thought of originally was integration, which is obviously when you have new linear infrastructure that supplies public transport, you can get people cycling and walking to the stops and then taking public transport, whereas before they would just take a car from A to B. And that's really important to take into account. And essentially, in our research, we found ways of quantifying the potential for each of these things, which I think is really exciting. Just recently, I've thought of a fourth one as well, which I think should be in there, but it's more difficult to evaluate. Which should probably go here instead of this big legend, which is the construction time. So when you're building these things, loads of trucks, heavy trucks, turning left and providing loads of unpleasant cycling conditions are going to be going around. So that's yet another one that that we've only recently thought of. So moving rapidly on, there's a nice example of linear infrastructure that's separated. So I guess that helps from a kind of safety perspective. So moving very quickly on, I've got a few diagrams that illustrate this. This is based on a real case study of Lewis Uckfield, and this just shows how we're using these desire lines to estimate the potential. And
yeah, I think if you, when you kind of evaluate it like this, you can identify basically this is the place where you're going to have a bridge, which, as you'd expect, is close to the city centre. But the central message is we have created a method that allows you to quantify some of these unexpected effects of infrastructure that is not for cycling that will have a huge impact on cycling. It's still relatively early days, so as you can see, we've only applied this method systematically to a small case study. But I think the next steps is clearly to scale this up and look at the actual impacts, quantifying the impacts on active transport of HS2. So thanks a lot for listening. Don't know if there's any time for questions, but very happy to hear them if there are.
I'm afraid not. I think we will move on to coffee. I have just a couple of other logistics. I'll just do a call out there. I think that severance modelling is key. All we've ever done historically is quantify it in a kind of, in a qualitative way. And I think to have some methodology for that is key. I'll just say that. Okay, hands up, please. So those are going to go to the left-hand sessions next time. That's 2.1. Thank you. Hands down. Hands up. Who go to the right-hand sessions?